time core teachers, Stephen Tierney, Kai Po Koshin is his Buddhist name. And Stephen began practice in 1994. And he first received the precepts from Thich Nhat Hanh at Plum Village in France in 1997. Stephen was ordained in 2013 and received Dharma transmission in November of 2021 in the lineage of Suzuki Roshi, founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. Stephen is also a PhD in psychology and a psychotherapist in private practice, and a professor emeritus of counseling at the California Institute of Integral Studies. So Stephen, and he is in Ireland right now. So welcome, it's 2 a.m.
And top of the morning to you, it takes on a whole new meaning tonight. Good to be with you all. I think my volume might be a little low. Can people hear? Everybody's okay. Okay, so it's great to be with you, and I want to spend a few minutes talking about sort of what we were talking about before the meeting started, which was the idea of so many things that in life that we have to be comfortable with the unknown. And one of the tools, it seems to me, that we use for that is the word hope. And, you know, we hope that we don't get COVID. We hope that nobody gets monkeypox. We hope that if you do get it, either of those two things or many of the other things, that it's a minor case. And we hope that all of our fellows and sisters use common sense and caution. Hope. And so, you know, it's interesting for us as Buddhists because we don't actually have that word in Buddhism. We are taught from the earliest teachings on to live with present moment awareness, present moment, to live in this moment. And as Pema Chodron taught very, very clearly, that she considered hope and regret as two hiding places where we could go rather than living in the present moment and being fully present for ourselves and each other. And so, you know, if you were a Pema Chodron fan, as was I for many years and still deep respect, it was a very confusing thing. It's like, I know as a social justice activist, as many of you also are, that I sort of needed some motivation to get out of bed in the morning. There were some elections in this country over the last decade that, you know, the next morning it was like, oh my, how am I going to possibly get up? How will we ever survive this? We hope that the country will right itself. We hope that people will correct this and do, we hope. And, you know, as Buddhists, it's like, well, the truth is we don't, in a sense, we don't hope. We say, here's what I have to deal with today. And how will I do that? How will I engage with that? For myself in my personal life and my practice and with others. And so there's this idea that as Buddhists that we not spend a lot of time thinking about what we hope for. And it actually makes sense if you think about it. Might sound a little squirrely in the beginning because it did for me too. But the fact is that what we're taught is to accept the world we know. And a wonderful teacher that I was reading named Nazreen Malik says, she takes it a step further. She said, accept that the world you know is falling apart and you don't know yet what a better world will look like. So there's if you accept that, you know, things that we stand for from a social justice standpoint or an anti-racist standpoint or a women's rights standpoint, LGBT, et cetera. And we know that you could really use the expression, as she did, that things are falling apart. And then we step back and it's like, and we don't really know what the answer to that is. You know, the answer I'm in Ireland where there's political stuff going on, not dissimilar to the US. And we get most of our news here from England, where, as you know, they just got rid of their Donald Trump, or they're in the process. He's kind of hanging onto the doors, but they're in the process of getting rid of him. But everybody, all the candidates, 11 people filed papers in the one day they were allowed to replace him. And every one of them was on TV today talking about hope, the hope for the future, the hope for the future. And then the reporters started asking questions about some specifics. And they all said, well, we don't know yet. we don't know what the future needs to hold or will hold. What Buddhists think and have been taught is a concept of sort of radical hope. And that expression in the teachings that I was able to find in the last few days really talks about, rather than hope being a state of mind or a wish or a desire, that hope, our hope in Buddhism, has a bias towards action. So it's appearing, living in the present moment awareness and having a bias towards action. So here's the present moment, and what can I do to show up as the best person I can be today, to be as connected as possible to all of you, and to be involved and engage Buddhism, as Thich Nhat Hanh and many others teach, that being on the cushion is not enough. And as you've heard me say at the retreat and other times, Thich Nhat Hanh was very clear that suffering is very foundational in Buddhism, but suffering is not enough. We have to do something about it. So one of the things that Nisreen teaches is that we need to get rid of our outcome obsession. You know, everything is about achieving a result, winning an election, losing, you know, et cetera, finding a cure for a specific disease, all of which would be great. But she says that the kind of hope that Buddhists practice is not, as she puts it, rainbows and unicorns kind of hope. Not rainbows and unicorns. She says that tends to be what she refers to as toxic positivity. And toxic positivity is what happens, she's teaching, when people in power or people with the resources say to poor people or disenfranchised people that everything's going to be okay. That if you're just patient, if you step back and look at the big picture, everything will be fine. And she says, Nisreen says, that true progress is a measure of things being different, but not necessarily better. So our commitment is to do the next right thing on the belief that it will create a world in which we want to live and we want to be connected to each other and we want everyone to live. So, you know, we do that right from our basic practice, which is sitting on the cushion. You know, over and over again, you've all heard and said and read about, we do not sit with gaining mind. So when we sit meditation, we're not actually looking for something to improve, including our own attitude in life. We sit because it returns us to the natural state of human beings, according to the Buddhist teaching. That being in repose, that being available to love and be loved, being aware, available for wisdom and compassion. And that's why we sit. Now, the result for most of us, or we wouldn't keep doing it, is that we feel better, our relationships get better, and sometimes worse and then better again, hopefully. But that's the process sort of what happens if we find ourselves in meditation. But again, meditation is not enough. But we have to really be involved in the world from a place of wisdom and compassion. So one of the things that is taught in that article that was in Lion's Roar is that optimists, these folks that, as she referred to them, toxic positivity or toxic optimism. And she says that you hear people say things like about a particular situation around race or gender or poverty, that progress, that we should be thankful for what we have, because the human race is on the longest winning streak right now in 2022 in recorded history. And if you think about transportation, healthcare, education, data, technology, that look at this, look at how much progress we've made. And she, of course, as many of you are right now rolling your eyes, because that does not, those things, as wonderful as they may be, don't apply to everyone. You know, if the basic need is food or safety or protection from aggression and violence, to have someone from a Buddhist teacher's place or anywhere else say, we're on a winning streak. Humans have made such progress. And, you know, we're recognizing that Black Lives Matter. We're recognizing transgender rights. We're recognizing the equality and need for women and people of all racial and ethnic groups to be at the table. We recognize all that. Well, that's great. But if you wave those flags and say, you know, everything's fine, everything's moving along, and we just have to be patient, it really dismisses and diminishes the real lived experience of most of the population, and certainly most of the population that any of us work with and deal with. So progress, the Buddha said, is relative and not absolute. And that I think that's a really important thing. So I was looking for what else does Buddhism have to say about hope? And one of the teachings that I found says that in Buddhism, hope is a reliable way to release ourselves from suffering, a reliable way to release ourselves from suffering, which goes with what I was saying just now from Nazreen's article. Because what it is it's not we're going to sit around and hope that we get released from suffering. It says that we are going to recognize as the first noble truth that there is suffering. And then we're going to recognize that we are called to do something about it. And so it is based on that we can protect ourselves from suffering through this practice. We can protect others. And in fact, we can build a better world if we do the reliable action. So the Buddhist teaching is very clear. He says that he said in his teachings that hope should is usually based on craving. And in Buddhism, what we should base our hope on is the steady energy of wise aspiration. The steady energy of wise aspiration. Example of that is when I became a person in recovery and joined the 12-step program, I got there and everybody said, they have a quote that they use, a slogan, don't leave before the miracle happens, hang around. You need to have hope and faith that this will work. And I thought, I don't. I grew up in a family where there was rampant alcoholism and addiction, and some of them had tried programs and meetings and hadn't worked. But that was the key for me when I realized that some of them had tried and it hadn't worked. But the wonder of a recovery group is that there are people in there who tried, who were as messy as I was, and some messier, if you can imagine, and it did work for them. They did in that particular set of actions. They took them. Some people had deep faith in a higher power and lots of hope, and other people simply did the steady energy of wise aspiration, knowing that if you took action, something would happen. Something would happen. In the Theravada tradition, there is the word sada, which can be translated as faith from the Pali. But what it really translates, another way that it translates, because there's so many translations, but another way is provisional acceptance. And I think that's another opportunity to think differently about something that's hopeful or faith. And it refers to one's aspirations and confidence in the path of enlightenment. So again, back to if we believe that that there are four noble truths and that the fourth one is the Eightfold Path, that there are ways that we can do the next right thing. There are ways that we can engage. And that makes a great deal of sense. And so this concept of sada is that I have a provisional acceptance. Because I'm looking around this room and folks have been in here for 20 years, and I'm assuming y'all wouldn't come back week after week if something in your life wasn't resonating as deeper and calmer and more peaceful and more connected. And so I have, if I'm newcomer to this group, and I was at one time, I experienced sada, that a provisional acceptance that there's something going on here that I want to be part of. And then the invitation in Theravada and in Zen, the invitation is to move into the Eightfold Noble Path. And you all know and remember, I'm sure, that the first is right view. The first one is right view. And in the teaching that I was working with today, right view is really eloquently and simply defined as a disciple of the Buddha understands that actions have results. Understand that actions have results. And if you know that, then you're able to say, so I'm going to do some things. I'm going to do some things and they're going to have some results. And I'm going to do them in connection with other people in my fellowship or special Buddhist friends, so that I know that as I'm taking these actions, that I'm not just off on my own running wildly about trying to fix everybody or doing those kind of things. So I think one of the fears and one of the things that makes Sangha so important is that we can wake up in the morning, or we can hear the election results, or we can read a report from some health agency. And we can think, and many people have, we were talking about this before the meeting, people are ready to be back to normal, right? People are really ready to get on with life, to you know, the enlightened ones don't say back to normal, they say back to a new normal, or to a new normal. And I think when we live in present moment awareness, one of the things we get to say is, so that normal that we were living in 3 years ago or 4 years ago, is that really where we want to go back to? Do we really want to be, some days I think the answer is yes, but by and large, the answer is no. That we don't want some imperfect new normal. We want to create changes in our lives, in the lives of our friends and family, in the lives of our communities, that will make a new kind of normal. With more justice, with more anti-racist work, with more rights for women and LGBTQIs and all other populations who experience discrimination and racism and oppression. So if we want that, how do we get it? Well, we do have the right, as we're sitting in mindful awareness of this present moment. We know that between 5:30 and 6:30 on Monday nights, we live in a place that is based on love and compassion and wisdom and connection, and a group of today 15 people who take very good care of each other, very good care of each other. And so that kind of hope is that experience. So in different parts of the sutras, the Buddha has described hope as something acquired through direct experience, gives us insight into change rather than just wanting change. So we look at our own direct experience. How did we get to a place where we feel safe, if we do? How do we get to a safe place where we feel healthy, if we are? And how do we create changes to increase both of those things? How do we create changes that make us better connected to each other? And it's based on experience. And then we take action based on experience rather than, as the teaching says, rather than just wanting change, we take the insight into change from our own direct experience. So wise hope, this is from John Dowd-Lowry, wise hope allows us to see things as they are, that nothing is inherently permanent or fixed, that Buddha's way is without expectation. So nothing is fixed. So we don't live in the kind of hope that says, I want it to be better tomorrow. I want it to be better at the next election. I want it to be better before summer is over, or whatever it might be. That we know that everything will change, and we know that everything is impermanent. And so we don't get to control all of that. Rami Shapiro, who's a Buddhist and a rabbi, says that the spiritual life is a set of activities that allow us to get rid of the illusion that life can be controlled and the delusion that we're the ones controlling it. So again, it's that idea that we get this wonderful opportunity to look at what's worked, look at what's working today, and take actions that are based on that direct experience shared with other folks. One of Thich Nhat Hanh's students, Sister Clear Grace, says that from that space of living with the understanding of impermanence, from that space, we get to see the truth of impermanence. We're able to create and, in fact, be the very hope which we wish to see. So we aren't practicing hope, we become the hope. Through our actions, through our meditation, through our engaged Buddhism, we become the hope. So I want to have some time for everybody to talk, so just say a few more things, but in Tricycle Magazine, Kurt Spellmeyer talks about the Lotus Sutra, and he says that what he recommends and what he understands the Lotus Sutra to be about, there's a teaching, a story in the Lotus Sutra that some of you may know about the ultimate body, and says that people tend to think of hopelessness and helplessness as the same thing. But he says that helplessness is actually a transcendent experience. And much like what I just quoted a minute ago, what he suggests is that when we feel helpless, we're recognizing, or we potentially could recognize, that we can't change the world, right? We would not be here in this meeting today if it weren't for the folks at Zoom, if it weren't for the folks that whoever makes the magic happen for the Wi-Fi, whoever built this computer and all of yours, whoever lets you all off work or dinner responsibilities to be here at 5:30 on a Monday. So it's all, you know, it's all that interconnectedness. And so there's that notion that we are kind of helpless. You know, we can do the next right thing in this present moment. But, you know, most of us know, you can just smile. You don't have to raise your hand, that someone could call you right now and you would have to leave the meeting because something else was up. Not everybody, but most of us. And so helplessness, this transcendent experience, is a place from which we can say, ah, so I'm not in charge of everything, but I can be active. I can do things, which might look like leadership, which might look like being a worker. But he says that it's really important in the Buddhist view for helplessness not to be a cause for shame or a condition to be overcome through heroic feats. And that what it really is a way of taking that deep breath and saying, I can't do this alone, probably, but what I can do it with others. I can do it in Sangha. I can do it, you know, with other people. So when we fully realize that events really are outside of our control, they belong to something larger in life. That's what the Lotus Sutra refers to as the ultimate body, the shared body of all of us, that we are one Buddha. And Indra's net, we are all each part of the one big net, individual with our own lives, but part of that net. So Shariputra, one of the Buddha's most closest advisors, almost uniquely welcomed this Buddhist teaching when other people were saying, what, helpless? I don't think so. And he would be expected, because he was so high up in the sort of rank order of the Buddhist followers, he would expect it, as many of the others objected to it. But he took several deep breaths and stepped back and looked at the crowd and said, no, we cannot do anything alone. Even going on a retreat means somebody has to put the retreat together. Having a meal means other people have to be involved in the meal, preparation of the meal and the cleaning. And so he says this way, on the one hand, there's not that expectation that you can fix everything. There is that expectation that together we hold the opportunity, the invitation, the responsibility to get things done. And there is such enormous freedom in that. And he says that the minute you realize that, a liberation, awakening, is just one breath away. So I think I want to stop there, because give us a few minutes at least to hear folks talk about what hope means to you in terms of your spiritual life. If you have any questions about what we said tonight. So thank you.
Steve, what was that quote? Something of wise desperation? That really lit up for me. What was the full phrase?
It was wise aspiration. I wrote it down. The steady energy of wise aspiration.
Right.
Oh, okay. Aspiration.
Yeah, not desperation.
Not desperation. I wasn't talking, not to answer you, Loki, but you asked for a specific quote from a 71-year-old at 2:25 in the morning. So thank you, Deborah. See, we can do things together.
Okay, yeah. That one works. But isn't it, can we hold both? I've heard this thing about hope and toxic hope. And another teacher I heard would say faith versus verifiable faith, based on our experience. But it's just another object in our consciousness. It's like, okay, I'm feeling hopeful when I should really be present with what I can do. But you have to recognize maybe that, because that's really pushed at us. That is something else that's there, along with all the other mind states that we have. So we can have both that kind of wisdom and.
Yeah, I think, sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, We have wisdom and compassion in Buddhism. Wisdom is knowing the Dharma. Compassion is putting the Dharma into action. So I think maybe what you're describing is some action that you would take. I think for me, and probably for some others, the idea of verified faith could send me to the library for years and years and years, looking at sutras and documents and verifying. So I think it's not that you're not correct. It's just that word for me is a little bit challenging in my life, because I spent a lot of years trying to verify spirituality and the Sky Daddy and all the other pieces of religion and spirituality. And so for me, I understand what you're saying, but I would be challenged a little bit by that word, verifying, as though I could judge what's, you know. But I think with the way you put it, verifying our own experience, that's, you know, the last time I spoke, I think I mentioned that Bell Hooks talks about enlightened witnesses or fact checkers. And she recommends that everybody have one or two or 15. So that as we tell our stories or talk about ourselves, that we have people that love us enough to say, you know, you took your relative to the hotel in Daly City and left them there. That's what you told us last week. And now you're talking about how tight and wonderful your family is. Is there something that you need to balance there? And the answer may be yes or no, but those kind of things in life where, you know, our stories change as we evolve, as our heart opens or closes. And sometimes it's good, as that expression I love, enlightened witnesses. So somebody else on the Buddhist path that can help us with really, as she said, very simply, fact-checking our stories. Because mine frequently can use a little fact-checking when I'm talking about how I got from 1951 to here.
One way that, Stephen, thanks so much for the talk. And I think it's so wise, because how often I find myself hoping that something's going to happen that is completely out of my control, from a sports team winning to that the weather's going to be X, Y, or Z. And I was thinking from your talk too, say about Harvey Milk's famous line, you got to give him hope. And I guess as I reflected on that, I thought, in my own experience too, that if one uses the word hope to mean something like not to have our minds set in a mind state of negativity, but an idea that something positive might happen, something could happen. And so it might, like say from the 1970s, it might inspire that person, as Harvey Milk was encouraging people to come out to end homophobia. So they would see the doctor, the lawyer, the, you know, everybody, blah, blah, blah. But if you have that hope that maybe what you do could produce change, then it gives you the strength or courage to go ahead and take that risk that part of you wants to do. And so if hope is met in that way, then it could be a really powerful, powerful thing, so that we're not just caught in, I think as long as you say, desperation or pessimism, that that doesn't control our minds either as much as toxic positivity.
Yeah, that was in John Dottolori's article. It said, hope not based on craving, but hope based on the steady energy of wise aspiration. Thank you, Logan.
Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah.
The wise. Yeah. Wise aspiration. Okay. I think we're done.
Yeah. Thank you, Stephen. And thank you all. Let's sit together for a minute as we close.